X movies. Shame on me or no? That's all right.
Shame on you.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. And finally, Gazette columnist Todd Dorman is with us. Hello, Todd.
Hello.
We're in a hurry because Tom Barton's Iowa State Cyclones are playing basketball in a couple hours as we record this on Thursday afternoon. By the time you're listening to this, you'll know the outcome of that game, and you'll know what kind of mood Tom is in at the moment. So let's get rolling. First up this week, it could very well be the last time, at least for a while, that we talk about area education agency legislation. Because this past week, the Iowa Senate passed, and then Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law, sweeping public education legislation that includes significant alterations to how Iowa's 9 AEAs are structured and funded. You could take up the whole podcast just explaining the bill itself. So the shortest possible description of this terribly complex bill and issue is that it will shift a small sliver of state special education funding and eventually all state funding for other education and media services straight to the school districts instead of going straight to the AEAs as it does currently. The bill also moves oversight of special education to the Iowa Department of Education and adds a new division of employees there to provide that oversight. And then beyond the AEAs, it's got the teacher pay boost and the state school funding in there. Todd, as far as the AEA provisions go, this final bill doesn't go nearly as far as Governor Reynolds' initial proposal, but it still has AEAs concerned and uncertain about its impact. What's your big picture view on what will become known as the great AEA debate of 2024?
Well, I think if you wrote a book about it, maybe the title would be, "It Could Have Been Worse." I mean, you know, that's the governor wanted to really just sort of yank the system out by the roots and do something entirely different. And this bill, which passed the House by only one vote, was about all that Republicans could come up with that they could get to her desk. So it's, you know, it's a lot more modest, but it does do some things. And it's kind of, you know, Kim Reynolds' proposal to redo the AEAs kind of came sort of like a bolt out of the blue. I mean, this has not been something that we'd been hearing, you know, heavy criticism of AEAs or AEAs or need to be fixed. You know, I don't know who exactly the governor was listening to, but she must have heard someone at least suggest this. And she had some test scores that she, you know, thought she could use to get it passed. But I don't know. It seemed like a bill looking for a problem that no one could find, except for maybe a few larger school superintendents that would like to get their hands on that money, because, you know, when you share the money, some of their share is going to other school districts in this sort of pooling resources.
Well,
so they'd like to have that money back.
Yeah. And just to jump real quick in there, apologize, Todd, to that point, it was interesting as the debate got on, and you heard from the few superintendents who were in support of this provision. And there was the one letter that I think the number was 17 or 18 school superintendents that signed on to it in support. And I believe it was 13 of them all came from the same AEA district. So yeah. it's sure. And look, I obviously don't know all the ins and outs of this, but from having covered the issue pretty in depth over 3 months now, it seemed to become apparent that there was maybe a problem with one particular AEA in western-ish Iowa, and then that because of that became the impetus for overhauling the whole system. I may be off on that a little bit, but that seemed to be at least partially the case. Go ahead, Todd.
I think that is right. You know, there were superintendents in favor, but I think if you'd, you know, before this issue came up in the legislature and came up as a big fighting point, if you'd asked superintendents in Iowa to write down 10 things you'd like the legislature to do to improve your school district, I don't think reforming AEAs would have probably made that top 10 list. There's a lot of other things they could be doing. But, and you know, the governor likes to open the door to private business taking over some of these special ed duties and therapy and other things. And that was part of her impetus for making this proposal. So, yeah, I mean, she's done private school vouchers. This would have opened the door. So I think we kind of see that the governor, you know, thinks that there are entities out there that can do a better job than The AEAs or the public schools.
Yeah, Sarah, I want to ask you really quick because I think I actually could have asked this question last week and I forgot to. But if correct me if I'm wrong, but after the House passed the final version that has now since become law, and then went into the weekend and before they came back and the Senate and governor did it this week. If I remember right, you covered a forum in your area there where obviously that was a big topic while it was still for one last weekend a live round. What was the discussion like there?
Yeah, so surprisingly, there actually wasn't any discussion about the AEA bill specifically. The lawmakers kind of got into it on just education funding in general. And I suppose there was some references. Mike Vondran, who is a first-term representative and actually used to be a spokesperson for the Davenport School District, he really defended that bill and talked about how it raised teacher pay to much higher than it, starting pay was previously.
Yeah,
And
from 33,000-ish to 50,000.
right. So yeah, so some Democrats kind of shot across the bow that the state was chronically underfunding education and so Republicans responded with, well, we just passed a bill that raised teacher pay and provided an increase to schools. And of course, Democrats said, well, there are several school districts that are having to cut services as a result of being underfunded. And so that was the discussion. It was a lot of more general discussion about education funding and the state's strategy toward education funding, but there was definitely some support for the bill. And then the one law I did talk to Representative Gary Moore, who's from Bettendorf. He voted against the AEA bill in its final form. And his main concerns were that the state did not put together like a task force to study changes to AEA and then do a bill. He really felt like there should have been more time in between studying what to do and bringing in parents and people and then proposing changes. That was one of his main concerns
Yeah.
about that bill.
We also heard that about once or 5 billion times during debate on those bills, didn't we, guys, from Democrats? Slow down the process, have a task force. Which, and I'm not mocking the suggestion, I'm mocking the redundancy in debate.
There were because there was a forum in Sioux City on Saturday for legislators, and there were at least two things related to, because there are a few questions about AEAs, and there were two things in particular that jumped out at me. One of them was that one of the representatives that was at the forum, Ken Carlson, when he was kind of doing his opening remarks, said, "We had most of the oxygen sucked out of the air in dealing with AEAs and teacher pay this week." And he did not say that in like a very like upbeat or even neutral sort of way. It was a
Yeah.
very, very negative and very annoyed sort of tone to that. And then when it got to questions from the crowd, one of the people who got up and asked a question was actually someone who works for an AEA. And she just asked the legislators that were there point blank why she should even continue working for an area education agency. And one of the legislators, Jacob Bossman, said that he thought the AEAs were going to continue to thrive. Ken Carlson, who I mentioned before, said that the AEAs are not going anywhere. And then J.D. Scholten, the lone Democrat, told her, "I don't know, just to fight back." So those
Yeah,
were
that's
in
interesting.
particular, yeah. So those were probably the two biggest things for us for AEA talk from over the weekend.
Yeah. Well, this is my terrible. I got so focused on second. What was the first one you just said, Jared? This is picture into my memory.
The first what?
The first of the two things that you just said that came up at the
Ken Carlson said we had most of the oxygen sucked out of
Yes,
the
thank
air.
you. And because I
Yep.
remember I wanted to circle back on that. That plus you can extrapolate that out to the whole session, really. We've heard a lot of lawmakers. In fact, just earlier today, again, we're recording Thursday afternoon, I was talking to a lawmaker and said, well, what's the rest of the session look like? And he said, well, now that we're finally done with the AAs, we can work on everything else and cram it all into these last few weeks. I mean, that has sucked all the oxygen out of the Capitol for the whole session, not just this past week. So I'm not surprised that you heard that, Jared. That's awesome. And Sarah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I had forgotten about this. You talk about the votes on the bill, and in particular, how the bill contained the teacher pay. There was a statement that went out from the Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman after the votes were cast, criticizing Democrats and a few in particular who just coincidentally happened to be in competitive districts in this fall's elections, which we'll talk about later with Caleb, criticizing them for voting against teacher pay, which I'll just say, holy cow, is that oversimplifying to a spectacular degree that I don't even know if I've quite seen in Iowa politics in my dozen or so years on the beat. And it also triggered, you know, one of those things that you've been around long enough, you start to hear things and you immediately think of something else. And I can already hear the campaign ads in those districts this fall saying that these Democrats voted against teacher raises. So I could start pre-writing my fact check story on those campaign ads now already, because obviously those votes, those Democrats made very clear in debate, and have, you know, state house Democrats have been very clear over the years about where they stand on teacher pay, and their votes against those bills were against the AEA portion and the school funding portions, which they said are too low. They said repeatedly that they're over this session, that they're in support of teacher pay. And in the House, they were able to do that because they ran a separate bill in the House. So, and just before anybody's pearls start getting clutched, this is not a partisan statement on my part. This is a fact checking and journalistic duty statement on my part. So it's going to be interesting to hear if that line keeps getting trotted out in the coming weeks, and then again this fall. And again, the other funny thing about trying to make that claim is, as Sarah noted, Gary Moore wasn't the only one. There were a number of Republicans who voted against these bills. So I guess apparently those Republicans were against increasing teacher pay too.
That's what Gary Moore said too, that he was very much in favor of teacher pay and raising the SSA, but that the AEA part. And I forgot to say earlier, the other reasons he opposed it were that it gave too much control, he thought, to the state Department of Education.
Yeah, we heard that a couple times too. And to put the final note on it, when they did that separate bill in the House, I'm 99% positive of this. I apologize if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. It was a 99 or whatever it was to one vote. There was literally one no vote on the just teacher pay bill. And I believe I remember who it was, but I'm not going to say it because I don't want to be wrong, and because I didn't ask that legislator why, so I wouldn't be able to give that reason here. But anyways, clearly the vast majority of Iowa state legislators were supportive of increasing teacher pay. All right, moving on from AEAs, maybe permanently on the podcast, which is a wild thing to say here. We move on to some non-AEA news that is, well, in some ways not actually news, but we did report on it. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd's final ruling on the state use of a victim's compensation fund to reimburse emergency contraception for victims of assault is still TBD. That's why I say it's not technically news. It's a kind of a shoulder shrug story. Even these 14 months after the AG office's review started, Byrd's office said it's still working through the review process. And this week, and here's why it sort of found its way back into the news, Auditor Rob Sand held a news conference to try to poke some holes in Byrd's explanations thus far, to the small degree that we've been given any explanation at all on this. So, Tom, you covered that. What's Rob Sand's beef here?
State Auditor Rob Sand, a Democrat, has accused Republican Attorney General Brenna Byrd of playing politics by freezing payments for sexual assault victims that receive emergency contraception, saying that she's hiding behind an audit to avoid accountability for her decision. Sand, again, the sole Democrat in state office here in Iowa,
criticized Brenna Byrd for pausing those payments while her office conducts its review of victim services, which, as you mentioned, has been ongoing since she took office more than a year ago. In particular, the state auditor took issue with Brenna Byrd's use of the term audit, arguing or saying that the attorney general's choice of words helps her avoid accountability for the decision that she made when she took office to, again, suspend these payments for emergency contraception for sexual assault survivors. The state auditor, you know, also made a point to say that his office is not conducting this audit. It wasn't asked by the attorney general's office, to conduct the audit, and kind of casting doubt as to whether, in fact, an audit is taking place, and saying that instead there might be an internal review that's being done by the attorney general's office. But again, taking issue with the attorney general's use, again, of the word audit, and trying to, in Rob Sands' view, you know, make it seem like, you know, this is kind of a, there's some sort of, I guess, detailed public accounting taking place of how money from that crime victim assistance fund is and has historically been used in the past. Sands also noted that, so I should preface in saying that before becoming state auditor, Rob Sand worked in the attorney general's office under former longtime Democratic incumbent Tom Miller, who Brenna Byrd defeated in the 2022 election. And Rob Sand made a point of saying that he's prosecuted rapists and pedophiles when he was with the attorney general's office, and said or accused Attorney General Brenna Byrd that you know, the trauma and pain he argued she's putting victims through with this pause in payment for emergency contraception is quote making his skin crawl, end quote. While the auditor's office audits the attorney general's office, it does not specifically audit the funding for emergency contraception, which is paid by convicted criminals through court-ordered restitutions and fines and penalties, going on to claim that you know, what he terms is a word salad by the attorney general is again pure politics and does a disservice to survivors of sexual assaults, as well as advocates and healthcare providers who provide these services and provide support to these victims.
Yeah. Have you, and I apologize if you said this, Tom, have we heard anything from the AG's office that gives us a timeline of when we'll finally get?
We have not. The only thing we heard from the attorney general's office this week is that their review is ongoing. They haven't finalized a report. And until that review is finalized, and until the report is released, which, again, they didn't give a specific timeline. They just said that it would be released soon. And until that is done, these payments will continue to be paused. And, you know, another issue that Rob Sand took with that decision is, you know, he said, look, government entities in the state, counties, cities, school districts, et cetera, regularly do routine audits, but don't suspend their operations while those audits are going on, right? And he said, absent you know, any kind of firm evidence or strong suspicion of massive fraud, you know, you don't just go ahead and pause the operations. And his argument is that, you know, over the decades where this has been, you know, the state's practice of providing reimbursement to pharmacies and hospitals that provide emergency contraception to survivors, that, you know, during those decades, there has never been, you know, any suggestion, insinuation that that money has been misspent or misused. You know, the Attorney General's office says that it's conducting this review. We really don't have a lot of, you know, concrete details, information as to, again, kind of the specifics, the nature of this review, what they're looking at, and what issues they have with, you know, the reimbursements that have been provided in the past.
You know, I can't imagine why anyone would watch NCAA basketball when they could sit down with the popcorn and watch this audit versus internal review debate, because that's some good stuff. It's an internal review. No, it's an audit. I mean,
the state capital geeks version of taste great, less filling, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, sometimes you might ask the rhetorical question, how dumb do our leaders think we are? And I think in this case, Brenna Byrd must think we're pretty dumb, because she's not going to spend state victims' money on either contraception or, in rare cases, abortion. It's no surprise. I mean, she's about as far right on the pro-life scale as you can get. And I don't know why she just doesn't come out and say, yeah, we're not going to provide this help anymore. We're not required to by law. I mean, of course, it's hideously callous to, you know, deny assistance to someone traumatized by a sexual assault, but we think, you know, being right on abortion is more important. I mean, she's just come out and tell us that instead of this constant, oh, it's the audit's coming out soon, any day now. I don't think it's sincere, and I would rather just see her be honest.
Well, and I'm not, you know, ascribing motivation here. But the fact of the matter is, Todd, isn't it that delaying the program is de facto killing it, right? I mean, is the longer right. This draws out, the longer the program is essentially, you know.
Right. It's, yeah, just, you know, calling it an audit suggests that there's something to be found. Or, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. There's a pot of money. It's been spent on these different things. And one of them is, you know, emergency contraception. And we're not talking about big dollars. I mean, I think it's usually in the, you know, the last time someone took accounting of the ones that were pending that aren't being reimbursed was, I think it was like $4,000, something like that. Mm-hmm. So we're not, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And I think everybody knows what's happening. So she could probably drop the ruse at any time.
Yeah. So as of August, which was the last time we had numbers, I guess, publicly reported from the Attorney General's office, the amount of pending claims was over $7,000. It was somewhere around like $7,500. But to your point, and also Rob Sand made this point as well, it's a minuscule amount.
Yeah, there's probably that much in the vending machines in the basement of the Capitol right now.
So with what they're charging for soda now, I bet there is. I hate to be all back in my day, but it's unbelievable. Like a 20-ounce soda is like almost $3 down there. So I'll bet there is $7,000 in those machines. Good Lord.
In between the couch cushions where the lobbyists sit, there's probably $7,500.
That may be true too. All right. Moving on, we saw some interesting activity at the State House this week regarding a couple of local issues and also some rarely activated state boards and committees here. So let's talk about those now. And let's start with an Iowa House Oversight Committee hearing on the City of Davenport's handling of public records, which that committee's chair called disgraceful and perplexing. Caleb, I know you covered the hearing, so fill in anything we miss here, but I want to start with Sarah on this one, because this all started in your neck of the woods, Sarah, and you've reported on this, what led us to get here. Give us the necessary background and then any thoughts you had on that Oversight Committee hearing and the legislative comments.
Yeah, so it was a pretty wide-ranging hearing about everything from the city's response to the collapse at 324 Main Street to the city's handling of separations with three now former city employees. In particular, the city council in October of 2023 approved without a public vote in a settlement agreement with its former city administrator, Corey Spiegel, with a payment of $1.6 million. And that included $1 million for emotional pain and suffering because of alleged harassment that she says she experienced at the hands of elected officials. And so this was in lieu, this is what city council members said was in lieu of a lawsuit that Corey Spiegel had threatened to file against the city for these past 8 years that she claims of harassment from elected officials. And so So October, the agreement's approved. In November, there were city municipal elections in which Davenport has a unique system where every council member and the mayor are up for election every 2 years. And then just before Thanksgiving was when the city announced that Corey Spiegel would be departing. And then about a week after that, they announced that they would be paying her $1.6 million and released some more details about why she was leaving. And so all during that time period, there was no public action related to these settlements. And the city attorney at the time, who retired in January, said that he had obtained council consent for these settlements and that it did not need to come before a council vote. And then on advice of outside attorneys, the city council did eventually bring those agreements into public session for a ratification vote in December. So several months after the agreements were initially signed and acted upon. So now the oversight hearing was, there was Randy Evans, the executive director of Iowa Freedom of Information Council, the Michael Malloy, who's a local attorney who has been involved in numerous public records lawsuits with his client, Alan Dierks, and a local resident, Ezra Sidrin, who's also been a very frequent records requester of the city of Davenport. So they testified. So after November, December, the public is really not happy with the city of Davenport. There are several people who request any documents related to these settlements, and including there is a settlement demand letter from Ms. Spiegel to, I think it's to the city attorney, I'm not sure, but that's a letter that's under litigation right now. The city of Davenport kind of preemptively sued Sidrin, Mr. Sidrin, or Dr. Sidrin, and asked a court to determine whether or not that document should be made public. So there's a lot of questions around, you know, Randy Evans said during the hearing that the city council, you know, can discuss settlements and legal action in closed session or personnel matters in closed session, but a final vote needs to be taken in public. And so Mr. Malloy filed a lawsuit saying that the city wrongly approved these agreements without a public vote and that they should be voided. And then there's the city Davenport lawsuit against Sidrin asking a court whether or not they should make the Spiegel demand letter public. There's quite a bit of legal action right now around these settlements.
Can I, sorry, real quick, Sarah, can I ask there, what is the justification for keeping that letter not public? What's in there that they say it shouldn't be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. According to the city in their filing, they say that they are facing threats of litigation from other parties. So two administrative employees who had their demand letters released had threatened legal action. And I think it's presumed that Spiegel wouldn't probably be too happy if the city released her demand letter, though she has not filed in court. I think the city sees itself as between a rock and a hard place where they think that they're facing threat of legal action for not releasing the demand letter from public records advocates and then from these employees who say that these demand letters should be kept confidential.
So I'm sorry, and I don't want to belabor this because we got so much to talk about. I want to move on. Did I hear right? Their justification for not making it public is that they're just afraid if they do, they'll get sued?
They're asking a court to make the decision.
Oh, okay.
And they're filing, they
don't want to make the decision. They want someone else to make the decision whether it's public record.
Yes. That's what they say.
Okay.
That was one piece of this that really stood out to me. And also the lawmakers on the committee seemed to be very upset that the city took this course of action. Is choosing to, in order to try to decide the legality of releasing that letter, taking the route of proactively suing a resident who didn't even request the letter specifically. He requested all communication with Corey Spiegel related to the settlement. And he was one of many people, including the Quad City Times, that requested that. And, you know, they named him as a defendant in that lawsuit. And looking at kind of those documents, that is an option that entities have in the state law when they are not, when they're in doubt about the legality of turning over a document. But they also have the option to seek an opinion from the attorney general or other attorneys. So, I mean, that wasn't the only option that they had. So that was kind of the theme. Another theme was that these lawmakers were very concerned about the seemingly aggressive legal strategy of the city, because they have, you know, they're resisting the subpoenas from the state auditor for information about this. So they seem to be taking a lot of legal action that's outside the norm for something like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. Caleb, what's next for, you know, at the conclusion of the hearing, what did legislators say about, like, are they keeping an eye on it? And did they promise any kind of state house action or anything like that?
Yeah, so the House already passed a bill that was kind of inspired by all this, that Representative Moore, that we talked about earlier, brought forward. That's passed out of the House almost unanimously. And then
what would that bill do?
Did
I put you on the spot? Sorry.
No, I got it. increase the penalty for people who violate state's open records or open meetings
law. That's right.
Also requires that that state elected officials get training on the laws are around open records. That one has been sent to the Senate. They have not taken any action on that. So that was the main thing that they said, is they really want the Senate to move this bill forward and get it passed. Representative Brooke Bowden, the chair of the committee, didn't commit to taking any further action this year. She said she wanted, there's a lot more information they need to get. They want to hear from the city. The city is, she said, would be difficult to come to the committee because they have so much ongoing legal action. It doesn't seem like there's going to be any specific action from the state house that was inspired by this specific meeting, but they do really definitely want to see that open meetings bill passed.
Yeah, I was going to say, with all the legal tie-ups, I suppose there's probably not a whole lot for the legislature to do at the moment anyways.
Yeah, and I guess we should say the city of Davenport was not invited to this hearing, but they do, it sounds like, want to hear.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Forgive me for not being aware of that. That's interesting too. Okay, moving on to another state board that doesn't meet very often. The State Objection Board met this past week to settle candidacy disputes brought by a couple of Northwest Iowa candidates for the state house running against each other in a Republican primary. Jared, you wrote about that meeting and these candidates. Tell us all about it.
So on Tuesday, the objection panel rejected challenges to the candidacies of Lamar's resident Travis Sitzman and Sioux City resident Noah Weisler, who are both running in the GOP primary for the Iowa House District 13 seat, which is being vacated by Ken Carlson of Ottawa, who's leaving after one term. The objections to each candidate's candidacy were concerned with the question of residency. The district includes all of Monona County, a good portion of central and northern Woodbury County, southern and eastern Plymouth County, and then parts of western Cherokee County. And the addresses that both men have listed on the Secretary of State's primary election candidate list, both of those addresses place them outside of the district. But something they both noted, and something the Iowa Secretary of State's office noted when I reached out to them, the residency requirement is 1 year in Iowa, 60 days in the district at the time of the election. Sitzman, who's from Lamar's, like I said, he got back to me and said that he was born and raised in the district and intends to move back within the district once the primary is over on June 4th. And then Mr. Weisler from Sioux City, like I said, he responded to me over email, and he said that the challenges to my candidacy were unfounded because the Constitution of Iowa is clear on the requirements for state reps. And ultimately, like I said, the objection panel, which includes Brenna Bird and Rob Sand, who we talked about earlier, they rejected those challenges to the candidacies of Mr. Sitzman and Mr. Weisler. So that race is going to continue as is.
Yeah. So it's the AG, the auditor, and the Secretary of State that are the 3-member panel, right? Yeah. So,
yep.
And that's interesting. It's not a panel that you hear from a lot, but the one example that that folks might remember just not too long before all this was Republicans challenged Abby Finkenauer's candidacy in 2022 in the U.S. Senate primary that year, and it was unsuccessful. Republicans challenged the panel's ruling in the courts, and the courts upheld the panel's ruling. So it's not a super frequent that panel is used and asked to rule on candidacies like that, but it was interesting that it was this week.
My favorite story from that panel, may have been the same year with the Abby Finkenauer one. It was one of these last couple of elections. I think it was a congressional Republican primary candidate in the Southeast Iowa district. It was his signature number, you know, something about his signature petition was challenged. And the morning of his hearing, he released a statement and a video just saying that he was ending his candidacy, that he felt it was not his time to, you know, no longer felt that it was his time to be in the race, never said anything about the objection, and never showed up to the hearing. So
that's exactly right. I remember that too. Yep.
Well, just that, because I know people have pointed this out in the past, because as you mentioned, we have had, you know, different degrees of residency issue stuff before, and a lot of them seem pretty difficult to enforce, even if there is an issue that pops up.
Yeah, I was gonna say that it's pretty rare that someone gets knocked off the ballot by that panel, and that's something I remember from covering that in 2022 when this happened. They're also, I say the word forgiving. I don't know if that's exactly the right word here, but that's what I'm trying to convey, is that like you have to really mess up your candidacy requirements for them to knock you off. That you got, you know, candidates kind of get the benefit of the doubt on some of these things that when the objections are raised. Todd, help me remember, and I'll do a quick Google search if you can't off the top of your head. Was it also the objection panel that weighed in that ultimately got Teresa Greenfield knocked off the ballot in the congressional primary, and was that 2018?
I'm not sure if they ever formally voted, but I think once she realized what happened and that her staffer had made up names,
right?
She dropped out.
Oh, that's right. She dropped out. But it was was it that the same panel that was like involved? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, this is the same panel that when Ron Corbett tried to run for governor.
Yes. Yep.
They said that he didn't have enough signatures, and that was the end of his candidacy. So. Yep.
Not super common, but boy, it can be a big deal when it is. So that was interesting. Finally, this week, let's talk about the Capitol, but through the lens of the 2024 elections. Caleb, you wrote a story this past weekend that did exactly. And first of all, don't give away too much of the farm here, because we want people to give you a click and find your story on your favorite Lee and Gazette website. But give us the Cliff Notes version of what you sort of found as you worked through that story, looking ahead to this fall.
Yeah, so there are several seats that the party officials in both parties are looking at as far as potential pickup seats in November. Republicans, as I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast knows, hold, you know, 2/3 of the Senate and more, nearly 2/3 of the seats in the House. And so, you know, they're reaching very large numbers, and they've even, you know, speculated in the past, you know, that they're maybe reaching the upper limit of how many seats that they can, you know, feasibly hold. But they still, this in the last couple of weeks of talking with the party leaders there, see opportunities to grow those numbers. And then Democrats in the House and Senate are, you know, not expecting to win a majority of the seats in either chamber this year, but they do see opportunities to grow their numbers, you know, build a foundation in, you know, a number of districts and work toward building back those numbers. As far as like districts that are going to be major battlegrounds, the Des Moines suburbs, again, and they have been for the past few elections, are going to be, you know, large battlegrounds. And it's where the Republicans said they're going to be focusing a lot of their attention. Places like Johnson, Ankeny, Urbandale. Ankeny representatives like Heather Mattson and Molly Buck both won by very slim margins in 22. Johnson representative Eddie Andrews, a Republican, won by a not very large margin as well. And so those are going to be big areas. And then the
and by the way, sorry, just really quick, because I have intimate knowledge as a resident, that Ankeny district, the other reason to display how competitive that is, you mentioned the two Democrats that won by small margins, and then collectively those two House seats form a Senate district that is actually represented by a Republican, Mike Bussolo. So that's obviously a toss-up district there.
Yeah, just that, you know, the Democrats are outside the suburbs. Democrats are looking at smaller cities like Bettendorf, Clinton, Ottumwa, Burlington, that at one point in the past were, you know, had been very strong Democratic seats, especially those eastern Iowa towns, but have, you know, since become, you know, very fairly Republican. And so they're looking at those seats as potential places to win back and you know, lay a framework for winning back in, you know, maybe 2 or 4 years. And so that's kind of the layout. And I think we've talked on here before about what the major issues are going to be, but it's immigration, it's abortion, it's the Democrats are really going to hit hard on the education stuff, especially in the suburbs. The AEA bill was not very popular among people in the Des Moines metro, as far as I can tell. So stuff like that, I think, is going to be a big, big issue this year.
And apparently Democrats are against teacher pay. Caleb, how much did anybody talk about the top of the ticket? And we don't have a Senate race in Iowa in this cycle, so there's nothing of that. So it's just the presidential race. Did anybody talk about that impact down ballot and how important it is, how well Joe Biden, obviously Trump's going to win the state, but how competitive Biden's able to make it, and does that affect these candidates in any way?
Yeah, I think Republicans feel like Trump's going to help them. He has, especially obviously in 2016, brought out a lot of Republican voters that weren't as dependable, and he may be doing that again. Obviously, he has the major support in this state, even. And so, you know, that him being at the top of the ticket is going to be helpful there. Democrats are Democratic. The Senate leader, Pam Yoakum, told me that, you know, they want to clearly express or communicate the things that they think Joe Biden has done really well as president: infrastructure, healthcare funding, things like that, that they want to, you know, make part of not central to the campaign, but try to kind of diffuse some of the Republican attacks on that front. The Democratic House leader, Jennifer Confers, told me that they want to keep the race very local focused. I think they want to, you know, keep things away from the top of the ticket, because I think Biden is so vulnerable and Trump is very popular in the state. So that's kind of how everyone's looking at it, I think.
All right. Well, obviously we'll have plenty of time to follow those and talk about those on future episodes, but that's it for this episode of On Iowa Politics. If you're not already, please subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice. You can also find the podcast each week on your preferred Gazette or Lee newspaper website. Now that you've listened to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you will receive all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to that free newsletter at the Gazette's website, thegazette.com. And lastly, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today, and we talked about some good stories, so make sure you get out and check them all out, can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Muscatine Journal, Cedar Rapids Gazette, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Mason City Globe Gazette, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Sioux City Journal. Victory Lap by Tone DeBoss is playing us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the podcast, please send us a sound file. For the whole gang, Tom Barton, Caleb McCullough, Sarah Watson, Jared McNett, Todd Dorman, and our producer, Bailey Chihan, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thank you for listening.
Can't get enough of the Gazette? Listen to the Gazette Daily News podcast for the latest Eastern Iowa headlines packed into bite-sized stories. Listen at thegazette.com or Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or through your Amazon Alexa device. Tell it to enable the Gazette Daily News skill, then say, "Alexa, what's my flash briefing?"